and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I have the great pleasure of being joined today by Klaas Knot, the former governor, recently stepped down of the Dutch Central Bank, and Bruegel's director, Jeroen Zetelmeyer. We are going to be talking about the economic outlook for Europe, the inflation situation, the possible energy crisis that could come in response to recent events in the Middle East, and also Europe's attempt to make itself more creative. Klaas, could you get us started by giving us your assessment of the European economy?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on this podcast. Well, you know, I mean, it's 4 or 5 days into the war between the US and Israel and Iran. So, I mean, this is pretty much a time of elevated uncertainty, if ever. But if I looked at where we were, let's say, last Friday on the euro area economy, it was a story of remarkable resilience. So domestic demand has been surprising on the upside ever since April 2nd last year. Trade impact has not been as bad as feared. The consumer is doing relatively well. Exports is holding up relatively well. The labor market continues to produce low unemployment. For European standards, absolutely low unemployment. Growth is pretty close to potential also in terms of projections of the various international institutions, including the ones of the ECB. And inflation is spot on target. I mean, it's as close to 2%, I think, as you will ever get it if you looked at the latest set of projections. Now, of course, the challenge is what has happened over the last few days. How are we going to make an assessment of how that will impact growth and inflation? It's going to be a negative supply shock for the euro area, a negative terms of trade shock because the euro area is an energy importer. But how big these effects are going to be will entirely depend on how long the conflict will rage and how high gas and oil prices will go. And I emphasize gas here because I think for Europe, gas is even more important than oil prices. And that is, of course, is very hard to say. But we do know that the shock that we have been seeing over the last few days will be a shock that will be a negative for growth, and it will have upside potential for inflation. Now, will that preoccupy the European Central Bank? Yes, of course it will. To some extent, we're a bit lucky that the inflation is coming on the back of a projection that had a slight undershoot of inflation for 2026 and even going a bit into 2027. And it's also good always to keep in mind here that monetary policy works with a certain lag. So the initial shock on inflation is always water under the bridge. The ECB cannot be expected to do anything about it. The ECB should, however, come to an assessment of what is the likelihood that this first wave shock will lead to second round effects. And that typically goes through the wage setting process. We have overlapping wage contract in Europe, so that means that the initial shock is taken, the initial hit is taken by the workers. But you might argue that this time around, the workers still have fresh memories of what happened in 2022. So if, and this is, of course, a big if energy prices continue to be elevated, then this time around, I do think that workers will be quick to try to get compensated and to undo the loss in real wages, the loss in purchasing power that will be the consequence of this. And that is what the ECB has to come to an assessment to. What can it sort of follow to come to that assessment? I think primarily follow the many gauges of inflation expectations, because that's basically what it is about at this early stage of the shock, because that's also a gauge of how much second round effects are there to be expected. So I can say what they will probably look at, but I can't say what they will see because it's way too early to tell what the magnitude of the impact will be.
What are some lessons from the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022 that you think might be relevant here?
Well, I mean, the lessons are, of course, that while standard theory prescribes that you should look through a negative supply shock like an energy shock, that you have to be very, very wary of non-linearities and these second round effects. So if you think that the shock is such that it is likely that there will be another round of wages pushing up costs, which might be lead to even a third round of wage increases, etc. If you think that that scenario is likely, then there is a limit to which you can look through the shock, because then you have to respond. I mean, that was the probably the assessment in the second half of 21 when we first had the first wave of inflation as a consequence of the reopening effect from the pandemic. There, the recipe was looked through, was transitory, and that was not only the ECB. I think all the global central banks took that approach. But then when the Russian invasion came in February 22, and then we had the explosion of gas prices, then it was pretty, pretty clear that this was going to have second round effects. And then we had no choice but to react. And then, of course, we were a little bit behind the curve at that stage because we had chosen not to react to the initial wave. But, of course, we couldn't know that the sort of second shock was forthcoming when we decided to look through the first shock. But that's always a little bit, as monetary policymakers, sometimes you're lucky and sometimes you're a little bit unlucky. Now, I would say that the policy reaction to the Ukraine shock was such that to the extent that we were a few months behind the curve, I think we pretty rapidly made up for it. And already at the end of 2022, we were at the curve again. And I think we were relatively successful in managing the disinflation process up to a point where the cost of disinflation have actually been surprisingly low. And that is, I think, an approach that, if necessary, and again, this is a big if, because we're only 4 days into the conflict and gas prices today are nowhere near where they were in 2022. But if a similar response was warranted, then I think the ECB would look back to the playbook of 22-23.
Jeremy, inflation is not the only measure of an economy. What else is Europe doing right now? And is it poised to be a player in the global economy, given everything that's going on?
As our listeners know, we have quite a lot of structural issues. We have done well in a cyclical sense, as has the United States, as has the rest of the world. We have the benefit of having a better balanced economy, lower inflation. But the structural issues, relatively low trend growth, relatively low productivity growth, issues with tech adoption, high energy prices in relative terms, and, you know, more broadly, difficulties, I think, in reconciling societal objectives that range from higher defense to fiscal consolidation, reducing polarization in our economies, dealing with demographic challenges. You know, those are the big challenges, and they're still there, and they are made more difficult by a geopolitical environment that is volatile, as we have just seen with Iran, but that's also characterized by protectionism, particularly on the side of the US, where, you know, the recent decision of the Supreme Court to declare President Trump's IEEPA tariffs illegal has injected some more uncertainty, I would say. And then we have, of course, the issue with China and their attempt to, in a sense, to export a demand weakness by directing their exports into the rest of the world. So what's known as the overcapacity problem here and as involution in China. So this is the big picture. It hasn't changed. It's probably become a bit more difficult through the Middle East crisis. And so what are we doing about it? So maybe one thing that can be mentioned is that today the European Commission released what it views as a landmark legislative act, a regulatory proposal, which now has to find its way through the legislative process, called the Industrial Accelerator Act, which is supposed to energize European industry. I'm a little ambivalent about this piece of legislation, but that's certainly something we can talk about more. And we can also talk more about fiscal issues and, you know, anything you want to pick up from the menu that I've just laid out.
We are, of course, recording this podcast on Wednesday, March the 4th, and it will be released in coming days, just so listeners have an anchor of where we are. Jeremy, you brought up overcapacity and China, and this is a tricky one because, on the one hand, some of our colleagues have written very convincingly that cheap Chinese solar panels are a net plus for Europe and that we could buy them and deploy them and accelerate our own energy transition. And at the same time, there is a lot of concern that Europe is not doing enough to develop homegrown innovation, homegrown champions, and maybe even homegrown manufacturing. What is your sense broadly of, is overcapacity even a problem? And then is the Industrial Accelerator Act the thing to do about it?
So overcapacity is definitely a big problem, but there is not a very simple solution. Moreover, it's not our only problem when it comes to competing with China. And the reason for that is that even if China were to take the overcapacity problem off the table, which it probably could not do immediately, but it could certainly really reduce the scale of the problem, for example, by revaluing its currency. Because what overcapacity has done is it has put pressure on prices, both in China and globally. And so with a more or less fixed nominal exchange rate, this means that China has become more competitive continuously over the last few years. I mean, certainly since the property bubble burst in 2021, which is one of the reasons behind this decline in demand. So, you know, there are things that China can do. But even if China did all the right things, nothing would change the fact that China has caught up with, you know, top of the line European manufacturing in virtually all sectors, and China is very big. So we have a structural competitor that implies that, for example, you know, German exports will never be the same again, right? We will never be as dominant in as many sectors in Germany and neighboring countries, Netherlands, Austria, Italy, and many other European countries as we used to be. China will remain the arguably manufacturing powerhouse, even without the overcapacity problem. And for this reason, we have to do more than just protect ourselves against overcapacity, which, you know, sooner or later will abate, including because it's not sustainable in China, right? I mean, these are loss-making enterprises, and, you know, the government understands that and is encouraging some consolidation. So it will slowly wane and may take a long time. But even after it wanes, we will still face a completely different situation competitively in export markets and third markets and also in Europe than we were in about 10, 15 years ago. And so the important thing, and that's the thing that gets forgotten in a lot of the debate about China, is that we have to prepare for that new world. We have to adjust. We have to find new niches. We will have to change most likely the geography of some of our production to really take into account comparative advantage within Europe, produce green steel where there is iron ore and where electricity is particularly cheap. This is probably not where it is produced now. We will have to also do some clever industrial policy, hopefully along the lines that emulate some of the successes that we've had in the past. The most famous one that Klaas knows a lot more about than I is in the Eindhoven area in the Netherlands, where there used to be Philips, there were skills, then, you know, Philips went down the drain, but the clever things were done with, I believe, largely horizontal industrial policy, so not subsidies to specific firms, but in a sense a way of strengthening that region that then attracted other players like ASML, which is, of course, the pride and joy of Europe, so essentially the manufacturer of technology that you need to make highly sophisticated chips. So we need this sort of structural change dimension. And unfortunately, all the emphasis when it comes to dealing with China is protection. So to stop or slow the Chinese steamroller. Now, I'm not saying that this is not important, right? So we do have overcapacity. We have artificially low prices, and so we need to protect ourselves against those. And so the emphasis on slowing down the steamroller is correct, but it cannot be the only one. Now, maybe a word on the Industrial Accelerator Act. So this is supposed to be essentially a protective instrument to make sure that manufacturing does not collapse in Europe, or ideally that it expands. There's some targets about how much it should be expanded, which are unrealistic, but this is mostly just flourish, so one shouldn't take that so seriously. But in substance, what this act says is that we should use government procurement and local content or domestic European Union content requirements to, in effect, redirect demand towards our own industries. And, you know, some of that is appropriate. What it lacks is this other dimension of, you know, strengthening the new stuff. This is all about supporting the old stuff. But we do need some support of the old stuff. And so the big risk here, in addition to the lack of a structural change dimension, was that it would be too protectionist in the sense of breaking our international commitments, and that it would not just discriminate against China, which is probably necessary one way or the other, but also discriminate against other trading partners that we want to do actually more business with, right? Because we want to reduce dependence on China. And so here, the European Commission needs to be commended for the fact that this aspect of the Industrial Accelerator Act was significantly toned down and in some parts entirely removed in the last few weeks. This is one of the reasons why the Act was delayed, because there was an internal fight over this, and the result is much better than earlier drafts that were leaked. And so, in a sense, the way to think about it is that the definition of buy European was expanded to include critical non-Chinese trading partners. There's still some issues with legality under the WTO, because you still cannot do conditions on subsidies that discriminate against particular trading partners, even if you define domestic content to include our friends, not just us. So there's still an issue there that we are weakening rules-based trade with this, but at least we are not doing it in a way that is really blatantly counterproductive to the idea of reorienting our trade relationships away from China and towards others. And so for that, I think they deserve some kudo. In the end, it is a reasonable compromise. It's some of this may be necessary. As I said, it's not nearly sufficient to achieve what we want.
If I may, I mean, part of my concern with the this act is also that it, of course, lands in an economy, the European economy, that is already not really an internal market, right? I mean, the internal market fragmentation is still quite significant in Europe. So there is, of course, a risk that what is then sort of being marketed under the heading buy European will actually become buy national, since the market is still so fragmented along national lines, and procurement is actually one of these barriers to the internal market that is very often identified. And then it would even go at the detriment of competition, the competition that is already unfortunately impeded too much. I think there are many places where Europe, I think, suffers from a lack of competition, and where we have too small domestic markets. I think that's also an element of the Draghi report, that we should build more scale, and that will also give more effective and efficient competition. But that this law, if it lands on an economy where nationalism is still there, then it may not strengthen European competition, actually. It may make it even more difficult.
Indeed. I think in this context, it's important to distinguish between two brands of buy European or from our friends. So one is literally government procurement. The other one is linking subsidies to the goods that the companies that benefit from the subsidies procure or use, right? So the local content in the production of the companies that you're subsidizing. The first of these is less problematic, because in principle, there are tough rules that do not allow national governments or local authorities to discriminate in favor of their own companies directly in procurement. The second one is a much bigger problem, because when it comes to giving subsidies, there is the state aid regime, which is supposed to, you know, control these subsidies. But this state aid regime has been significantly weakened last summer in July, when the Commission came up with a new interpretation. And in essence, what it says, the weaker state aid regime, is that if you want to subsidize energy-intensive companies, you can do pretty much what you want, so long as these companies are also engaging in carbon abatement efforts. And so here, indeed, you're completely right. So there is my fear that, you know, those countries that have bigger fiscal room, they are going to do a lot more subsidies for their own companies. You can also do things like industry electricity prices, which of course to any economist is by far the worst form of doing a subsidy, because you're distorting prices and making it less likely that companies will adjust to higher energy intensive efficiency. So all these things are really bad, and they are part of the spirit of our times. However, they are not today's news. They were the news last July. We should probably have written about it and slammed the state aid regime more. We didn't, but maybe we can sweep it into some evaluation of everything that has happened in this area.
Thank you for that. Interested listeners can find out more about specifically the Industrial Accelerator Act in some reports on our website, Bruegel.org, and we do a lot of work on this issue. In the next part of our podcast, I want to take advantage of having Klaus on the show to ask about the Dutch economy. We've previously done looks at the German economy, France. We've got an episode on Italy coming up. We've never really looked at the Netherlands, despite its role as one of the more fiscally important countries in Europe. It's generational shift from defined benefit to defined contribution, pension plans. Of course, it comes up in every conversation about capital markets and the savings and investment union. Klaus, where do you see the Dutch economy in the European context? What are some of the good things and what are some of the challenges?
Well, thank you very much for this question. If you separate the cyclical from the structural, then I think we can be very brief about the cyclical. I mean, the Dutch economy has been doing extremely well from a cyclical perspective. We have unemployment rate below 4%, and it's been there already for a long time. We even, I think, the economy was overheated too much. That was also one of the reasons why inflation was structurally higher in the Netherlands than on average. We're gradually now sort of getting a little bit more flexibility in the labor market again, because the labor market was extremely tight for many, many years. So from a cyclical perspective, I think things are pretty well, and the Dutch economy has shown to be quite an agile economy to respond to sort of external shocks. The problems are entirely on the structural side of the economy. And basically, I mean, there's been a calculation by economists from the bank, DNB, and also from the Bureau of Economic Analysis in the Netherlands, that if we wanted to sort of retain the social welfare arrangements that we have today well into the future, we would roughly need a tripling of the productivity growth. So low productivity growth has been an issue in the Netherlands. Over the last 10 years, labor productivity was just a little bit over 0.5% per year. Mm-hmm. We will need somewhere between, to land somewhere between 1.5% and 2%, given the aging that is also coming our way. And that is where the challenge lies. Now, productivity growth, we all know, it doesn't fall out of air. You need to sort of work to get higher productivity growth, and then you run into a lot of bottlenecks. So on the supply side, I mean, our electricity grid cannot keep up pace with the sort of greening of the economy. So lots of new businesses nowadays can't start up because they can't get an electricity connection at this moment. We have a nitrogen problem because we've for many decades had an almost industrial approach to agriculture, which has led to the situation that there is way too much nitrogen being emitted. It's in the air, it's in the ground and everything. And that problem has become so big that the judges in the Netherlands have ruled that there cannot be any project anymore that emits additional nitrogen. But that means that the construction sector is on hold. That means that building infrastructure is not possible because there's a lot of nitrogen emission involved. And this has also been a bottleneck that has been with us already for quite a while. The housing market is super overheated. There's a scarcity of houses. We lack like 300,000-400,000 houses relative to sort of what would be necessary. That gives all kinds of rigidities also on the labor market among young people who can't leave their house and have to live with their parents for much too long. Licensing has become very problematic. The Netherlands is a very densely populated and organized country, so every piece of land is already allocated several times, and there are several layers of local government that want to have a say in everything, and understandably so. So these are, I think, the bottlenecks that really the new incoming coalition now needs to tackle. Over the last 2 years, we had a government which was not so successful in tackling any of it. It was held hostage a little bit by the partial interests of some of these groups that were against, or at least that didn't see benefits in removing, let's say, these obstacles. But now I think we have a government with a more forward-looking agenda that is very serious about sort of removing these obstacles and unleash more potential growth again. Now, one of the strongholds that you mentioned, we're all talking about the need to have savings and investment union and to have more risk-bearing capital in Europe. In the Netherlands, we do have a supply of risk-bearing capital because of our mandatory pension system, which has as a consequence is that old age retirement savings for the typical Dutch person is like 50 to 60% invested in equities. I think that is a good example, I think, for the savings and investment union. The Dutch system is quite a sort of mandatory system that you couldn't design anymore today. But auto-enrollment in pension funds would, I think, be a very good example. It's less paternalistic than having the system that we developed in the 1930s and that grew into where it is today. But it would still sort of, those, let's say, retail investors that are saving for their old age retirement, it would give them a sort of default option, which is a lot better than the default option that you see in many other European countries, that is, take your money to the bank and have your old age retirement savings on a savings account doing 0.5% or 1% interest rate. And luckily, that is a weakness that we don't have. But the labor market has become so much more flexibility that the old system, defined benefit, as you mentioned, was no longer maintainable. The price of guarantees in a volatile market and in a low interest rate environment is humongous. So therefore, we are moving now from a defined benefit, a largely defined benefit system, to something that I would call collective defined contribution. So there's still an awful lot of solidarity in the system. It's not a pure defined contribution because there are solidarity buffers in there. There's a lot of collectivity that remains also in the new system. But the important difference is, of course, that there is no longer a promise what your pension is going to be when you turn 67 or 68. And today, in today's system, that promise is already there when you join the fund when you're 25. And that's a little bit ridiculous or overdone, I would say. But the new system will focus much more on what is actually there in terms of investment and what is your part of that investment pool. And it allows for life cycle investments, so to have a much more aggressive asset mix for the young people. And then when you gradually turn older, you change sort of these equity claims into more safe debt claims, which I think is also optimal from a social perspective. So I do think it's an improvement. It is also having a little bit of an impact on financial markets because, of course, there is less demand for ultra-long bonds. There's less demand for hedging interest rate risk, as was used to be the case. But all in all, I'm pretty optimistic that I think it gives the system reason to survive and to be optimistic for a couple of, you don't know how long, but at least for the foreseeable future.
Thank you for that. Auto-enrollment, of course, is only possible when you have a pension system to enroll in, and not all European Union countries have that system, but it's something that is part of the Commission's SIU, Savings and Investment Union plan, and something that people are looking at going forward. Jeremy, we've just heard a very rosy look at the Netherlands and its approach to a lot of these common challenges, but we've also seen the Dutch be a very conservative force at the European level when it comes to joint debt, when it comes to other sorts of things. And sometimes the Dutch are seen as even more hardliners than the Germans. So where do they fit into a European context, given our need for public goods like defense and a linked up energy grid and things like that?
So I think that this impression is outdated. So I do not think that the Dutch are more hardline. I mean, it's sometimes, we are sort of neck to neck, and sometimes the Germans charge ahead and sometimes the Dutch. But I have a sense that the Netherlands is like the Scandinavian countries, like the Baltic countries, like Poland, quite happy to consider some form of common debt financing of rearmament. which is not true at this point for Germany, even though Germany may get there. So I do believe that, you know, certainly with the new government, the Netherlands are, as they often are, you know, culturally affine to Germany, but a more pragmatic version. And, you know, there has been evidence for that also in the past, not in the very last government, the previous one after that, when, for example, the Netherlands and Spain together wrote papers on how to reform the fiscal rules and so forth. So I do think we can learn quite a bit as Germans from the Dutch there, not only on the pension system. I was wondering, can I just have one question for Klaas on this super interesting stuff on the Dutch economy? So I'm not sure it was that rosy, because the productivity growth problem is a very big one. And more or less, I sort of got the sense, the feeling from the way you described these obstacles, that maybe some of this is congestion related or pretty structural, which would then make it quite depressing, you know, because these are not things that can be very easily changed. I mean, we have, you know, land use laws in some places that unnecessarily restrict growth and make development more expensive. But if you have a very densely populated country, there's obviously less room to turn on that screw. And so what is your sense of, you know, how much scope is there for policy to remove some of these productivity growth obstacles?
Well, key, I think, to any future Dutch growth model will be what happens to the agricultural sector. And there is, I think, a beginning of an understanding that there is too much agriculture at this moment in the Netherlands. But of course, you are aware that this is a sector that brings about a lot of emotions that people feel very strongly about. But it is a sector that only contributes, let's say, 1.5 to 2% or so to Dutch GDP. But it occupies, obviously, more than 50% of the territory in the Netherlands. And territory is one of the things that is pretty scarce. It occupies quite a bit of the nitrogen space, if you may say so, that you have in the economy. And the same is actually also true for carbon and other greenhouse gases that are a consequence of the very, very intense form of agriculture that has grown over the years. So I do think that there are some tough choices ahead. And the previous government did not manage to make these choices because some of these interests were in the government at that time. But I think the new government has clearly spoken the intention to make these choices. You should also see that, also realize that as long as we had the Groningen gas field, we had the cheapest energy of all countries, obviously, because it came out of the ground, right? We also had for a very long time a belief in wage moderation and relatively cheap labor, and sort of the labor laws on labor immigration were relatively flexible. So we were sort of an economy that was built of cheap labor and cheap energy. These two things are gone.
Like Germany, to some extent, like Germany.
These two things are gone. And people begin to realize that if you have a lot of scarcities, spatial scarcities, emission scarcities, etc., that you actually have to redirect your economy to higher value-added activities. And that maybe some of these low labor, cheap gas activities that have grown a little bit out of proportion relative also to the size of the Dutch economy, that they will inevitably have to shrink and make place for more what you just already referred to, the Eindhoven cluster, which is, of course, a very high tech and high value added type of cluster. So tough choices will have to be made. Redirection is going to be inevitable. And for some sectors, that will mean shrinkage or at least very, very restricted growth to make place for these sectors that can produce the productivity growth. But it is a transition, and transitions are never without pain.
And it reminds me a lot of about Germany. I mean, the main difference is, as far as I understand, you know, land use and agriculture is not quite the binding constraint in Germany that it might be in the Netherlands. But the general idea that some of our competitiveness in the past 20 years or so, I mean, in the case of Germany, between the Hartz labor reforms in the mid-2000s and maybe 2019, when we felt generally very good about our economy, some of this was a bit hollow because it was built on this combination of cheap gas from Russia and wage moderation, and not really on, you know, competition, productivity growth, ICT adoption, structural change, right? Counterexample, possibly Switzerland, which was outside the euro, suffered several real appreciation shocks, less energy-intensive industry there, and perhaps more of a pressure to adapt continuously, right? And so we, I mean, the lucky economies with relatively high wage moderation and low gas-based energy prices, we have to do a lot of structural change in a short period now. No, I think in that sense we are in the same boat, and maybe that's also perhaps what distinguishes us a little bit from the Scandinavians. No, the Scandinavians are interesting because they have, you know, the same advantage on fully funded or defined contribution weighted systems, but productivity growth way higher, right? So the Netherlands is a weird mix between Germany and the Scandinavians. You have the same capital markets, super vibrant, the same fantastic pension system, but you have low productivity growth. Whereas the Swedes and the Danes, they are up there with the US. No? So
yeah, we suffered from the same flaw that too often competition was equated to competitiveness, yes, was equated with cost, exactly, competitiveness and not with productivity, yes, and not with innovation. Yes. And unfortunately, that's a mistake that I also think, yes, is made too often at the European level, because if you also look at Europe, we have a current account surplus. So you can't say we have a cost competitiveness problem. We do have a competitiveness problem in terms of lack of innovation, in terms of lack of productivity growth. And interestingly, the Netherlands and Denmark, they have a completely different approach to the minimum wage. So minimum wages are much higher in Denmark than they are in the Netherlands. But in the Netherlands, there was a problem that the minimum wage was no longer sufficient. It didn't sort of allow these people to make a living out of it. And then we made the tax system so complicated to hand out grants to sort of tax relief and everything, because people at the minimum wage couldn't live out of it. And that has made the tax code enormously complex. Whereas in Denmark, higher minimum wages, higher productivity growth, and a much simpler tax code.
Thank you for that. In the last part of our podcast, I'd like to step back and ask each of you some kind of big picture philosophical questions about economic policy and its role. And the first one is, how do we explain why higher wages can be a problem? This is a really difficult thing to say in an ordinary context, but in macroeconomics, we say it all the time because higher wages is linked to inflation. So for an ordinary person, how would you tell them that it's bad if everybody's wages are going up?
Well, I think in terms of inflation, you need to be really even-handed when it comes to wages and to profit margins, right? You can't sort of tell wage earners that they have to exercise restraint because inflation is too high, and then at the same time you see profit margins going through the roof. So if you call for restraint, you should be even-handed, because inflation is above target, or you have a problem and you want to disinflate, then you have to make sure that you're pretty even-handed in treating both wages and profit margins equally. And that also, as a central banker, you don't always take issue with trade unions and with wage growth, but that you also direct your public commentary sometimes on profit margins. And that was an issue in 22-23. I mean, the initial hit was, of course, absorbed by the workers, but as a consequence of the rapid price increases and the staggered wage contracting, profit margins initially increased quite a bit. And then I think you have a responsibility as a central bank to show to the workers' community that you also have a keen eye for the other source of inflation. At the same time, inflation is a regressive tax that nobody ever voted for, right? So it should not be a problem to explain to workers that inflation is particularly costly for low-income workers, and that there is a joint interest in bringing inflation down as quickly as possible.
I think it's also obviously important to emphasize that there is a difference between real wage growth and nominal wage growth. This was implicit in what Klaas just said. So we are sometimes worried if real wage growth is very high, but this happens to be in situations of unemployment. And that's not where we are. And I think, you know, some of the biases that you refer to in the motivation of your question, Rebecca, have to do with the time when we still had high structural unemployment problems in Europe. That motivated then a set of labor market reforms in my country, which by and large were very good reforms, but they had some unintended consequences, right? They obviously led to some problems in particular pockets of the labor force where you had employed but very low-wage people. So there were distributional issues that came out of it. But then the other issue is that we lost a little bit this real wage growth as a driver of innovation and upscaling, right? So the competitiveness model, in a sense, overshot in the direction of having a relatively low-wage economy, something that probably we couldn't have done outside the euro because appreciation would have taken care of it. But in the context of the euro and particularly the euro area crisis that limited appreciation, I think it led to this sugar high for the German economy, where we were doing very well for cost competitiveness reasons, which were not going to generate longer term growth. And so, you know, even at that time, I was in the German government 10 years ago, 2014, 2015, and I was working for a social democratic economy minister. Our view was that unions were not aggressive enough. We were telling them, you should be more aggressive, right? But this came out, I think, of this sense of collective responsibility for high employment levels.
If wage differentials within the monetary union do not one-on-one reflect productivity differentials, what you then get in relatively strong economies like Germany and the Netherlands, that, of course, the external value of the euro is a sort of weighted average of the external values of all the eurozone economies, which is probably leads to a lower euro than had the Netherlands and Germany still had their own currency. And it is a sort of boon for the exporting sector of countries like Germany and the Netherlands that being in the euro, having this collective group of countries keeps the external exchange rate probably a little bit lower than would otherwise be the case. Now, conversely, of course, for those countries that had a weaker exchange rate, had a weaker productivity tradition going into the euro, it's the reverse, right? I mean, they have joined a currency arrangement that provides a stronger euro for them than their own currency might have delivered had they still had their own currency. And I think you have to be aware of these intra-euro area differentials as long as productivity growth is not one-on-one reflected in wages. And that's typically not the case because also trade unions obviously look at each other cross-border and they compare, and they benchmark and compare themselves. But I think this is one reason why countries like Germany and the Netherlands should really be grateful for being in the monetary union because it gave them a boon to their export-oriented sectors.
But maybe also made them a little bit lazy.
Yeah, and it made them a little, not enough having to be on your toes, as it were, in terms of competing on innovation, on productivity growth, because you got the cost differential for free.
So how should the ECB do its job in a monetary union where countries do grow or lag at very different speeds or inflation can be very different in different countries? How should the central bank manage that monetary union?
Well, I think the first realization is that conducting monetary policy in an incomplete economic and monetary union is far more complex than if you have a one-on-one relationship between the central bank and the fiscal authority in a rather homogeneous country. So, for instance, in the euro area, one of the problems is that financial markets are still very much fragmented along national lines. There is weak coordination of fiscal policy, so ownership of the euro area fiscal stance is also problematic. Then you have a single currency, but unfortunately you have national debt issuance. You have a European single currency, but you have national debt issuance, which means that the one short-term overnight interest rate that the ECB sets then gets transmitted along 21 different yield curve to the borrowing costs that are relevant for our citizens, for our companies, for our households. That means that the spread question is never far away. And we've had many episodes in the 14 years that I was in the Governing Council where the spread issue was squarely at the table, and I think it led to the situation, and I think it was Mario Draghi who made us see this in 2012, that the central bank will have to accept some form of lender of last resort responsibility. Before 2012, the idea was no, that was up to the governments, they were responsible for their own spread and their own policies, etc. But I think within an incomplete economic and monetary union, we should all be very grateful for Mario Draghi for having sort of shown us the way in that direction. It's at least something that I was not aware of before 2012. And these shortcomings, and the longer I've been in the governing council, the more receptive I've become for sort of these, design flaws, however you want to call it. That probably implies that you need to have a little bit more activist central bank than at least the one that I was taught when I was at university and very much brought up in the tradition of moderate monetarism, as we call it in the Netherlands, which is a little bit of a derivative of the more Germanic monetary policy from the Bundesbank. But yeah, you have to think these things through, and it is what it is. I mean, having a common currency also means that capital flight is much easier because there is no currency risk anymore. Well, that also gave an additional layer of instability during the Eurozone debt crisis. So you cannot turn around as a central bank and say, oh, that's not ours, we're not responsible. Well, it's something that you have to deal with.
Where does climate and climate risk fit into this activist central banking model you're building in your head?
Conceptually, very simple, to the extent that it affects our mandate. If you believe that climate, and which I do, that climate change affects, for instance, food prices and the way food prices are being determined, then it affects our primary mandate, the inflation formation, to the extent that it affects financial risk. Not only that a central bank itself is running in its own assets and its own investment, but also financial risks of financial entities in the economy, then obviously it affects financial stability. And most central banks have supervisory responsibilities, have responsibility for financial stability. So also there, the correct pricing of climate risk should be taken into account in risk assessments. And the central bank has a role in fostering and stimulating that. So I do think that climate change affects several strands of central banking mandates, and through the lens of a mandate, because there I think you need to be disciplined, through the lens of the mandate, central banks should therefore be involved in climate change.
What would that look like?
That is, I think, what, for instance, the European Central Bank is doing at this moment, to the extent central banks are not climate policymakers. Governments are climate policymakers, and most of the tools that we need, carbon pricing, whatever pricing, they are in the hands of sort of elected officials, not in the hands of unelected technocrats, central bankers. But central bankers have to prepare themselves for the consequences of climate change on their mandate, and that requires work, because this is a new area, it's hugely uncertain, historical data doesn't help you much because the climate is changing, so you need to do thinking like scenario analysis, these scenarios need to be thought through, they need to be developed, and everything. So it needs a lot of original thinking, it needs investment from the central bank in capacities, etc. I strongly believe that is the right thing to do.
Chairman, how do you see the balance between traditional central banking monetary policy jobs, this need to be an active lender of last resort, and also stay within the mandate and not get too activist or too political? Like, where's the balance there in your view?
It's pretty clear that with respect to the medium-term objective, there cannot be any trade-offs. It's price stability and nothing else. It's also clear that conditional on that objective, the central bank can play a supportive role for general economic policy purpose. That's the, if you like, secondary objectives. Now, notably, the ECB has not used this argument in its support of effectively the climate transition in the financial sector, because it thought that the more logical way of doing it was through the primary mandate. But of course, you can use that route. And the other thing you can possibly play with is the definition of the medium term, right? So to the extent that there are admissible trade-offs, they're not on price stability over the medium term, but possibly how you get there. Now, I'm not sure how much this should be finessed, but it is a technical possibility. You know, other than that, I think that, you know, the really big questions are about, you know, the fundamental problem that one should not try to overburden the role of a central bank that in any case lives in a much more complicated environment as the steward of price stability and financial stability in a currency union. So the ECB has a more complicated job anyway. And so to try and impose on it, you know, a corrective function for problems in the rest of the architecture is an issue, right? And unfortunately, the ECB has been in there, particularly at the time of lowflation in the 2000s, at the time of the euro crisis, where it had to go to the edge of its mandate because of failures elsewhere in the system. So this is why the ECB has always an intrinsic interest in good governance. So this is, I think, where I would see it. There are some new debates. So I wrote about this with Lucrezia Dreichlin about, you know, whether in some contexts we should think of interest rate policies as having supply side effects, including through climate investments, through other type of investments. Once you go down that road, you know, it gets complicated. But it's not the time to go into that discussion now, I think. I think it's incredibly interesting. I think there is, in principle, a simple way to thinking about central bank, which is what Klaas described at the beginning. And I think that there are two settings where one, you know, that way is challenged. One is because of imperfections in the policy frameworks around the central bank, particularly fiscal and structural, that then lead the central bank into a temptation of perhaps going too far in offsetting mistakes of others, in effect. And the other one is that there are some genuinely difficult trade-offs in monetary policy that, you know, possibly may change over time. And then you have to update yourselves. And this is what strategic reviews are there for.
And because of this sort of incomplete environment within which the ECB has to operate, it's also, in my view, perfectly legitimate that the president of the ECB writes this letter to the leaders with the wish list of the five structural reforms. Of course, I read some criticism here and there that the central bank became too political and this and that. But I beg to disagree strongly with that. I mean, these incompleteness and these inefficiencies, they hamper the operation of monetary policy. They hamper the conduct of monetary policy. So it is perfectly legitimate for monetary policymakers to continue to signal to political leaders that the environment that they have created for the central bank is far from optimal and is complicating the conduct of monetary policy.
It's a great note to end on. Thank you so much for that explanation. Thank you for your time today. And thank you, listeners, for sticking with us. This has been The Sound of Economics. We've been joined by former Dutch Central Bank Governor Klaas Knot and Bruegel's Director Jeremin Zettelmeyer. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. You can find the archives of this show and all of our related research at our website, Bruegel.org. Thank you for listening and see you next time.